the clients I've learned the most from have been the activist and movement groups that we have counseled beginning in the 1950s with the resurgency of activism in the United States. These are the people I think we can really learn from, because they're the only ones that have a different view of the world than we do. And if there's anything that I've learned in 35 years of working in public relationships, and notice that phrase, public relationships, it's that it's very hard to learn from people who see the world the way you do, but it's so easy to learn from those who see the world differently. And if I have a theme for managements of organizations, I think that's it. That if we who are responsible for building the public relationships can really find a way to get our fellow managers to see the world as folks who don't agree with us see it. And I don't think I have to tell any of you that that doesn't just mean saying this is what they think. But if we can ever get them inside that mindset, organizations become relevant and trusted. And I have never found another way to make organizations relevant and trusted. And we'll talk about that for a couple of mornings. My job, according to Ron Rohde, is to make you do one of two things. My job is to make you, after we split up tomorrow noon, either be able to justify what you do or to start changing. Now, given that kind of an assignment, I think we better have some fairly clear ground rules. The first one is that I expect you to interrupt and tell me I am full of beans whenever you think so, and I mean that very much. If we can get some discussion going here, I think you're going to learn a lot more than you are listening to me lecture, and I should warn you, I could go on for probably 3 or 4 days without stopping. So you got to stop me when there's something that needs to be said, challenged, discussed, heard in more depth, okay? That's your job. The last thing I want is the old difficult situation of the professor that had to tell his class that, you know, it's my job to talk and your job to listen, and I'm afraid some of you finished ahead of me. I'd rather none of you finished ahead of me if we can possibly avoid that. The second ground rule is that if my voice is too high for you, I apologize. I'd like to tell you that it's the high cut of these English suits, but I'm just stuck with that kind of a voice, and so you'll have to, you could interrupt me and tell me to modulate. I've been trained in all that, but sometimes it gets away from me. Thirdly, I broke my cufflink on the way over here, so if a piece of it flies and hits anybody, I want you to know right now I have no liability coverage, okay? None whatsoever. Let's take a minute to talk about our relationship, since we're talking about relationships. I want to establish right at the start that the reason that I'm here talking, and for at least a couple of minutes, you're listening, is not because I know any more than you do, it's not because I'm any smarter than you do, and I want you to really understand that the advantage that someone like me has is simply that consultants get to flit around the country. In my case, the United States, Canada, and the United Kingdom, and to some extent, our Latin American neighbors. We get to flit around the country and find problems and say, this is how you ought to solve it, and then trot off to Juneau, you know. And then in Juneau, we tell them how to solve it and trot off to Orlando. And I am very conscious of that difference, that you're going to be here tomorrow morning and that you have to really solve it. And I just want you to know that I do understand that difference. That I understand that you are dealing with those same players in place day after day. And to me, that's the great challenge of public relations and building public relationships, as opposed to just communicating, just advertising, just marketing. You know, if you're setting out to sell 50,000 of something, whatever it is, and your first shot at a market doesn't work, you can find 50,000 somewhere else. 50,000 customers somewhere else who will buy it. Relatively easy. But in public relations, it's the same people, day after day. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we could say, hey, it didn't work out with those 79,000 employees we got, get rid of them, and we'll start over. We don't have that luxury, and that's why I talk about building public relationships as opposed to public relations. And maybe we should just, for a minute, talk about that. If we want to get credibility for what we do, I think we have to be a lot more careful about our semantics. That's my perception, at least. There's been a lot of arguing the last few years. Your department is called the Department of Corporate Communications. A lot of people have picked up these euphemisms. for whatever internal political reasons. Other organizations are switching back to that broad umbrella term public relations. I don't want to get into that subject. I think that's maybe a detail. But I am concerned that we use the term public relations to cover both the technology, the vocation, the profession, if you will, and also, too often, we just throw that out as if it were the result of what we do. But it isn't. It is not the result of what we do, and that's why I try to be very careful about being sure that we understand the difference and use the words differently between that, which is a description of our calling, and between that, which is the outcome that we are striving for, public relationships. Because I think if we express ourselves to our fellow managers as builders of relationships, somehow they can understand that. Whereas when you talk about public relations, they bring to it such a basket of misconceptions that I find, at least, it's much harder to penetrate through that. So, fully understanding that you're the ones that are going to be here tomorrow, let me nonetheless share with you some of the things that I've been noticing. Some of these things are my own ideas, and you may tear them apart mercilessly. Others are simply what I find in my travels in dealing with a really diverse group of organizations, many of whom are in at least as much trouble as Bank of America, and also because I do publish here, I'm the editor anyway, of one of the older newsletters in the field called PR Reporter. Thousands of our colleagues are sharing their cases and problems with me all the time, and I do a fair amount of speaking for PRSA and other groups. And so what I want to share with you is this sort of an overview that comes to me out of this unusual diversity of experience that's available to a consultant, and which is really very tough to amass if you're stuck every day working with those same audiences in the same location. Let's talk about the environment in which we're working today, because I think this is sort of the key to everything that follows. If you stop to think about it, if you're really willing to get basic, human society is, after all, the result of public relationships. I sometimes wonder why many people in our field sometimes seem to apologize for what we do when, in fact, nothing, and I mean that very sincerely, nothing is more relevant and to the mark than this right here, because this is a definition of civilization, of human society. What could be more important than that? All organizations, all nations, all societies, tribes, whatever they are, exist only because relationships have been developed that enable them to work together and achieve whatever outcomes they decide for themselves are justifiable or laudable or desirable. And there's nothing more to it. You can talk a lot about the new technology. You can talk about how the problems are different today than they were in the 1600s. I'm not sure they're any different at all. In fact, I'm sure they aren't any different at all. Today, when we have a difficult situation, what do? We tend to try and come up with some kind of a ringing phrase that will epitomize the situation and win people to our sides, like, we want the job. Well, Charles I tried that too. He was having a little trouble with his constituency in England, and so he set a task force of his public relations people to work. They didn't call them that then, but they were. Unfortunately, the phrase they came up with wasn't too successful. What they recommended and he started using was the divine right of kings. As you probably know, there were some follow-up activities that didn't work out too well, like he got his head chopped off, you know. But is it any different? I don't think it's a bit different. And if you're a reader at all of anthropology, I think you'll agree that it's been this way all the way along. Well, if that's true, and by the way, if you want to challenge that, you'll have to talk to some higher authority than me. Because everything we know about history, about psychology, sociology, anthropology, political science, tells us that this is true. Now, if that is true, then why isn't public relationships the core of every act and policy of your organization and of every other organization? I suspect that it isn't, because those of us who are the keepers of the flame, the guardians of this idea, have not been reminding our fellow managers of just how deeply this cuts. So one of the things I hope to do is share with you some thoughts about just how we might do that. There's another way of looking at this, besides saying that public relationships are the basis of every organization and society. You might say that every human interaction or transaction is really based on the idea of confidence. I either have confidence or I don't have confidence. And relationships are most closely linked to confidence. Now, this is no news to anybody in this room. We all know this. But when we carry out our daily activities and when we make our plans and our policies and our strategies, is this where we start? Is this what we think about? Or do we get lured off into thinking that if I could just give them a little more information, boy, that would do the trick. Or if I could just, you know, get a little more color into those ads, boy, that'll knock them over. Well, you'll have to answer that question for yourself because it's your work I'm talking about. But unless you are very atypical, this is considered kind of, well, you know, it's a cliche. We all know that. Now let's get down to the hard stuff about what we've got to accomplish today. I'm suggesting to you that the hard stuff is the basics. And that's essentially going to be my theme. So if you're getting ready to argue with me, be thinking along those lines, because that's where I'm coming from. And I'm coming from there because I think the evidence is so overwhelming today, and I want to share a lot of that with you. Certainly banking, more than any other field, depends on this. I'm sure you know what attitudes are. Attitudes are nothing but stored up thinking. That's what an attitude is, stored up thinking. I've thought about something so often that I don't have to think about it anymore. In fact, I don't have the time to think about it anymore, so when you bring it up, I just immediately leap to my attitude on the subject because I don't want to go through the rational discussion to get up there. Confidence, I suggest, is in a typical relationship, a similar relationship to trust. After we do things a few times and it proves that I can have confidence in you, then I will begin to trust you. And this trust, built on a repetition of confidence, then becomes an attitude. It's stored up. And it's therefore hard to dislodge. So if I can get enough instances of confidence, I can build trust, just as after enough incidents of thinking about something, I will build an attitude. Now, this implies something. It's the reason that I'm mentioning it. What this implies is that the SOCO communication, the wonderful event, whatever it is, that's going to bring people around, or the wonderful phraseology, or the film, or whatever, does not and cannot in human society exist. Because this is a process, repeated over time, stumbled, repeated again. And what this means to me, therefore, is that building public relationships means having some kind of process management. If this is a process, then the building of public relationships really depends on having a management of that process. And what we as practitioners do, or ought to do, at least in my opinion, is to have such a process. And I wonder if we do. Well, if we don't, let's see if we can devise one. If we're going to have such a process, obviously we have to know certain things. We have to take certain positions. And let me just tell you where I'm coming from, what I think those positions are. First of all, I think we have to understand the environment in which public relationships are built today, because it is different than yesterday, and I want to share that. And this, of course, is not only the external environment, but then against that, one has to know the internal environment. I think that's first. The second thing is, if we know that environment, we have to be very clear on exactly what public relations can do. If I pass around a sheet of paper now and I ask you all to write down, this is exactly what I can prove And that's the key word, by the way, today. The key word in public relations is evidence. What's your evidence that it did something? Or before the fact, what's your evidence that this might work? It's a new word. We haven't always treated it this way. What's your evidence for what public relations can do in your organization? Well, I've got a handy-dandy little list. You know, consultants are supposed to have handy-dandy little lists, and I'll share my list with you, and then you can see whether you agree, and maybe I can talk you into thinking about a list of your own. The next thing is, how can we present our ideas as if they were hard data? Now, you know what I'm talking about. I'm talking about that criticism of us that says we deal in all the soft fuzzies and the warm fuzzies, and that's just soft, that's PR stuff. Whereas when the lawyers come in, wow, they bring in those briefs. Clearly, that's hard data, right? Hard data. Is it hard data? Well, if a brief is such a sure thing from the lawyers, and you know how it is in the board meeting, when the lawyer comes in with his brief, man, it's all over. I mean, there it is. That's the hard data. The discussion stops. How hard is that data? Well, if you want to test it, next time you're involved in any kind of legal action, just say to your attorney, well, since that's hard data, you will, of course, then guarantee to win the case, right? Funny thing is, I don't think you'll get any takers. I don't think they will guarantee that it's going to win the case, simply for this reason. A brief, like any other postulation, begins with a guess. In fact, a number of guesses about the environment, about how the case is going to go, but that brief proceeds with process management. There's a management method for the process of how you're going to deal with a case in the court of law. And what I'm suggesting is that we need that process management for how you deal with a case in the court of public opinion, because then our data, too, will be seen as hard data. Or take the accountants. You know how that is. You talk a little bit, and you're arguing in the meeting, and suddenly up shows the accounting department, and they've got this printout, and then everybody just goes right to the printout. Or when a board meets, they spend all their time talking about the budget, you see, about the profit and loss. Not how we got there, not how we're going to do better, not how we're going to get out of it. But I have never been to a board meeting, and I serve on several boards, and I sit in on several boards. I have never been to a meeting where that didn't take up most of the time, is discussing these numbers. Hard data, right? Well, if you think it is, go back to your office. Take last year's actual operating results, or your own actual budget, or whatever, and then take the accounting department's postulation of what those numbers were going to be for that year and put them side by side. And if they're the same, please send me a copy, because it'll probably be the first time in human history. Because that data isn't hard either. It begins with a postulation, with a guess, with a number of guesses. But they have a process for managing their data that makes it appear hard. What can we do to get similar kind of attention paid to our data, our ideas, particularly since public relationships are a more powerful factor than economics or than organization, law, if you will. Certainly, we've got that on our side, and we now need to have methods for being listened to. Then, of course, we've got to set expectations. If we can't set expectations, no one's going to listen to us for very long, and all that means is planning, and I want to talk a little bit about how, in fact, we plan. Oh, there's one other thing. There is one other thing. Seems to me we also need to develop some counseling skills. How are you as a consultant to your fellow managers? Do you think of yourselves as consultants to your fellow managers, or do you think of yourselves as people who go in and are asked to have an answer, and you have the answer? A lot of organizations make that a virtue. When I call you in, Joe, I want answers. There's a president of a famous college back east that has a sign on his desk that reads like this. DBMP, BMS. Well, naturally, you know, people ask what it means. And he's quick to tell them, don't bring me problems, bring me solutions. A lot of people think that's wonderful counseling. You come and you say, boss, I think we've got a little problem here, and here's how we ought to solve it. I want to persuade you, if I possibly can, that that is the worst thing you could do. If you really want public relationships to be seen as an endemic part of the organization, that there are, in fact, counseling skills and that we can use them. Well, let's back off that for a minute now and talk a little bit about the environment, this environment in which we function, because it has changed, and that is the reason that I think what is happening is happening. Let me talk about it in these terms. If that's an organization, its products, policies, interactions, relationships, and so forth, and of course they're all subdivided and sub-subdivided, we all know about that. Until maybe 10, 15 years ago, managers inside an organization could change this at will. They could rearrange the deck chairs. There was time to do this, there was luxury to do this, and people who came along with good ideas could just kind of say, well, let's try it this way. And then about 10 years ago, we woke up and realized that that wasn't happening so much anymore. We began noticing that this boundary out here, where the organization meets the infidels, has become indeed the manager of change, because the infidels are always crashing over the boundary, demanding that the organization change. And so suddenly, about 10, 15 years ago, change was a result of what some management scholars call boundary management, meaning managing right here at the boundary. The changes here are made to reflect what's happening out there. And that the luxury of making a change inside just because, gee, that was a good idea, in any broader sense at least, isn't done. And certainly no one in here today, no intelligent manager, would suggest making a change that didn't conform to what's wanted outside. Now, if you think about that for a minute, that is revolutionary, absolutely revolutionary. And of course, it was part of a revolution, the new American Revolution of the 60s and 70s, when people who'd been going to school for years and hearing all that wonderful stuff Tom Jefferson wrote suddenly said, hey, that sounds pretty good, let's try it. And so for the first time, we really decided to try it, that we were going to empower every American on every issue, because that's what it was all about in 1776. But don't kid yourself, in case you believe all that political rhetoric, it didn't happen until the 1960s. The 1950s, according to the historical experts, was the most repressive, unfree decade in American history. And if you remember back to the man in the gray flannel suit, the organization man, McCarthyism, the media, which was indeed an extension, an arm of the government, there's just ample historical evidence that that was the case. In fact, that's how we got involved, as I said earlier, in dealing with public issues. In the 1950s, a group of basically Quaker ladies and some of their Mennonite friends were fearful that maybe our military effort would blow up the world. And when the government decided that it was going to put nuclear missiles into submarines, they were sure that it was all over. So they went up to the New London Naval Base in Groton, Connecticut, and they had a little powwow, and they realized how serious it was, and they figured, well, we're in America, we'll address the government, and of course it will listen to us. Well, as you can imagine, the Pentagon was anxious to hear their point of view, as always. So when that didn't work, they figured, well, then there's always the media, because we have freedom of speech in this country, and of course they'll be anxious to hear us. Well, of course, the media literally was an extension of government. The New York Times told those people, believe it or not, to check with the Pentagon. Can you imagine that? In the 1950s, the New York Times says, check with the Pentagon? Well, of course, they were Quakers, and you know, they've made most of the social changes in Western society, or they've been at the core of them for at least 250, 300 years. So they look back in their history, and they remember that little thing called civil disobedience. So these little old ladies climbed in the back of the trucks entering the base, dressed in fatigues. Some wonderful pictures of that, these gray-haired Quaker ladies in their fatigues, you know, sneaking into the base. They cut the fence, they lay down in front of other trucks, and you know the result. Suddenly the media was awakened to the fact that, hey, you know, we're not an extension of government. This is too good a story to miss. It just happened that In that group were some of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference people, including Martin Luther King. He said, "Wow, look at that." Went back south, Rosa Parks, refused to move from the front of the bus, and you know what happened. It was all over, that old kind of society. Now, we all know that. I'm not telling you anything new. And yet I find that it has still not penetrated the real heart of the management of our organizations and institutions, that this new American Revolution is here now, that people demand a voice and decisions that affect their lives. And if you don't give it to them, sooner or later, they're going to punish you, as AT&T found out, and we'll talk about that in a minute. If indeed boundary management is what it's all about, then we have to ask ourselves, who are these managers at the boundary? Well, it sounds to me an awful lot like what public relations people do. This whole model, it seems to me, is nothing more than a model of public relationships applied inside the institution. And we have some fairly good recent evidence for that. All those wonderful so-called management books, you know, the One-Minute Manager and the Excellence series and so forth, so-called management books, which of course you and I recognize as public relations books, because that's all they are. Wasn't it clever of us to con Peters and all those guys, Blanchard, into writing those books and calling them management when really they were public relations and they made our points in a way that we haven't been making? Well, if this is true, if boundary management is what it's all about, and we are the people at the boundaries, then I think we need to look just a little further into why this is even getting more important than it did in the 60s and 70s, because it is. Basically, there have been four changes in management philosophy in the history of American management since the scholars started charting it in 1900. You're probably aware that the first real managerial studies were done in 1900 at the General Electric Company by a guy named Fred Taylor. Fred remains one of the hated names in some circles because the original management studies were time and motion studies. And would you believe the workers didn't like him looking over their shoulder with his stopwatch? They thought there was something inimical about that. Since then, however, the scholars tell us that four things have happened that have forced managers to change their views. The first was the rise of professional managers. Until, the First World War and a little before, the milieu of management was something you were born into. I mean, I was president of the textile mill because my dad had been president and his dad. And probably the family owned the company. Since business traditionally has set the tone for management, at least in the United States, that meant that the local hospital, the local school system, the church, the government were run on a similar model, very autocratic, dictatorial, cronyistic. And that was the way it was done. And then all of a sudden, and I can speak about this with a lot of fervor because remember, I'm from New England, where all those old businesses were, then all of a sudden the blood started to run thin. And George Q. the Sixth couldn't handle it. So we had to kind of ease old George out to his yacht and bring in a professional manager. You all know the story. But if you think about the differences that that made, they are or ought to be critical. Because now for the first time, the CEO is also an employee. I love all the speeches that our CEOs and our senior managers give. Our employees, hey Jack, what are you? You are an employee. Well, maybe I shouldn't say that at this bank, but in any event, they are, oh, you can laugh, it's all right. I mean, he's not here, he won't care. They are employees too. Therefore, what this ought to mean is that those of us inside the organization really learn to interact. We really build super relationships because it's kind of us persuading them, the owners out there, that we're doing a good job. And so the hierarchy and the prerogatives and all that stuff really ought to sort of go by the board, shouldn't they? Because it's really all of us and them out there. Gee, you see what I say? These ideas maybe take a little while to sink in. But that was the first change, was professional management. The second change was good old double-entry bookkeeping. Double-entry bookkeeping. As long as I owned the company, I was not going to keep double-entry books. I was going to keep cash books only because I didn't want anybody knowing what the assets and liabilities were. That was my business. But then along came the income tax and the IRS. Interestingly enough, we have a client a few states over that is very large and still family owned. And literally in the 1970s, the IRS had to sue that company to get them to go to double entry bookkeeping so they could meet the IRS standards, because they were just telling, you know, what happened last year, and that was all. Major change. And notice that in both of those, notice what's happening here. Accountability in a new way. You can't just go to Sunday night supper at the house with dad and uncle and the family and say, gee, this is why it was so bad last year, but don't worry about it, I can still handle it. And that took care of it. Those days are over. The third change, relatively recent,